Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Stephen the Warman Writes Kickfighting Podcast Show. I'm your host, Stephen the Warman. You are listening to this podcast in one of two ways. Either you are at my direct blog, which is lordgaul.podbean.com. I try to upload something to that once every week, once every other week. But as I mentioned in the last few episodes, I'm committed to giving you guys an episode every week, at least through March. Trying to make sure that I don't miss anything because I had a busy schedule there and I wasn't getting as many shows out as I normally like. So I'm back on my A game. So you'll have something at least once a week. Adding to that, you can also find my podcast on iTunes. Enter Warman Kickfighting Show into the iTunes search engine and my show pops right up. So I am fresh off of watching the Lion Fight card. It probably happened a couple hours ago. I'm pretty excited to bring it to you because, of course, I'm a big Iman Barlow fan. And it's a really good opportunity for her to come out and compete in the States for the second time, put on a good show. I also really enjoyed just the card in general. They had a lot of good fights, a lot of entertaining action. And I'll talk about that. I'm going to talk about some stadium shows, talk about some news, and then I'm going to finish with a series that I kind of decided to start because of a conversation that I had on Twitter where we were talking about what makes someone great, comparing different eras, and sometimes it's fair and sometimes it's not fair, and in this situation it came up kind of weird, but I want to go ahead and start to do that. I'm going to probably do one, I don't know if I'm going to do one every week, but I'll do one every other week, every once in a while. I really want you guys to know what indeed makes someone special, different, I mean, beyond the norm. It's something that I think that when you see it, when you experience it, when you hear about it, it just comes off so much, so much more different than you could ever imagine. So I definitely want to make sure that I represent the sport at the highest and I give you guys a breakdown of what truly is greatness to me when it comes to combat sports. So I'll go ahead and get into the Lion Fight card. As I mentioned before, there was a lot of good stuff. And I thought that once again they put on what I would feel is a really entertaining card. I think that in every situation you kind of got to do the best that you can with what you have. And I think that they've done above and beyond and they've grown their brand so much. It started off with something simple, with them basically, building off of athletes like, Kevin Ross, Tiffany Van Soest, trying to make Muay Thai, special. And it's hard to believe that they've been doing this for 5+ years now. They've been around for a long time. It doesn't seem like it's been that long, but for a Muay Thai promotion or a Muay Thai brand in this, day and age, consistency is huge, having regular shows is huge, and it just hit me that when I was filming the kickboxing documentary, I had, Lion Fight was going on, and they'd start getting on TV, and Mike Chevelle, when he did an interview, he mentioned, in the documentary, he mentioned it. I don't know if I got that part in the documentary, but when I was going through my clips, it was cool to see that he mentioned Lion Fight that long ago. So they've been doing their thing for a little bit now. So good for them. They switched their business model up a little bit. They decide to make the top of their card represent the better fighters in the world. So that's why you've got, your Iman Barlows. That's why you've got your Fabio Pincas. That's why you've got some of those super, talented athletes that have world-class resumes, but may not, sell a lot of tickets here in the States. But it gives people in the States the opportunity to see the highest level. So they use their undercard with amateurs who are local, who can help put butts in the seats, and that's important. And then they use the lower portion of their card on American Muay Thai fighters who are looking to be consistent, who are, very much in need of fights. Like they need the volume of activity that it takes to catch people, because without that, you've got to do it with practice. You just got to train and prepare, and sometimes it works out in a situation like, with Josh Chauncey, and most of the time it does not work out. It is, you just don't get enough and you go against somebody elite and you lose. So I thought that Lion Fight did a good job of putting together what I thought was an entertaining card. Now, not all these cards mean that the top of the fight at the top is awesome entertainment. Sometimes it's just an awesome showcase of a really good talent, which is what we have here tonight. But I thought they did a good job of, to the best of their ability, putting together a show that has grown all the time, and it has more and more reflected some of the better talent in the world while still continuing to give fighters in, you know, North America, you know, mainly America, the opportunity to compete and grow. So go ahead and jump right into the card. I'm going to go from the top down as Regent Ursel gets another KO stoppage. Three fights, three KOs for the Dutchman. And this one is one of the prettier ones. He comes in, he landed clean from the beginning. And every time he threw with some intentions. DC Pratt, I don't know what DC Pratt's full resume is. It said that he was 20-3. I didn't know if that was all kickboxing. I didn't know if that was some kickboxing, some MMA, some boxing. All I know is he was in there with just a demon of a guy. A guy who was ready to go out there and get a KO from jump. So Regent Ursel comes out, landing big shots from the beginning. DC Pratt never got going. I think he threw a shot here and there, but most of the time I think he was just trying to feel out the rhythm of being in that big of a fight. And before he knew it, the fight was over with. Regent Ursel had landed the jumping knee a couple times, one time early in the round, but you know, to Pratt's credit, he just kept battling back. I won't say battling back. He stayed on his feet. You know, battling back means he bit down and kind of started throwing the heat right back. I thought this one, he just, after he survived something, he kind of hold on to the clincher and step back. And it was almost like he was still trying to figure out the moment. And while this was happening, Regent Ursel just continued to pour it on. The jumping knee, the first one didn't get him. The second, you know, even though it landed clean, the second one didn't land clean. It landed kind of right around the pec area. But as he came down, he put a right hand behind it, and that's what put DC Pratt down. DC Pratt got up relatively quick. I thought that they could have kept going if they wanted to, but I think, you know, the ref was looking into his eyes, didn't think that he was all there. He made that decision, and it would have probably been different for Pratt had he offered some offense kind of before it happened, but I really think that he was kind of like outside looking and trying to figure things out, and he was losing while he was trying to figure things out. Not just losing, but he was, you know, a guy was trying to kill him. So we'll see what happens. You know, again, I don't know the full extent of DC Pratt's full resume, but he was clearly in there with a guy who outmatched him. Now, again, now for the next guy they find for Regent Ursel, it's got to be a legit contender. It's got to be somebody that can push this guy a little bit. Three fights, three KOs. Now, again, beating the Joe Nottawatt, that's you know, solid stuff to win that by head kick, because that's tough to do. But he's a good-sized dude, and there's solid opposition out there. You've got to bring that in for him next. We can't have another situation like this. Three KOs in a row, that's cool. People like KOs, but we want to – he said it himself – Bring me a test. Bring me somebody that can push me. And I think that there are definitely guys out there that would love that opportunity. You know, you've got some people who, I wonder what, you know, Kareem Gaethje's situation is. But he's a name that kind of pops to mind because he's in the Bellator contract. And I don't know if they'll let him fight full rules Muay Thai outside of it or not. But he's just the type of guy that I think Ursel needs to fight. He needs to fight someone, you know, who's going to push him a little bit. Or, you know who I'm going to choose? Alim Nabiyev. Go ahead and bring Alim Nabiyev over from Europe, and let's see how he goes in there with Regent Ursel. Also really, really long, really slick. The crowd would love him. I think that he'd do a good job of selling himself to an American audience, because he does a great job of selling himself in general. So that's the one I want to see. Regent Ursel versus Alim Nabiyev would be a lot of fun. So go ahead and move from there. We're going to go ahead and go to the co-main event, which, of course, was, as I mentioned before, Iman Barlow, as she, you know, for the second time, they've met once before, but Iman Barlow is one of the better fighters in the world. This is one of her better performances. She, you know, she goes out there and gets a... The scorecards are only 50-45, which reflect the person that won the fight, you know, so that's definitely what you want to accomplish. But her victory over Miriam Usla, it was so, so clear. It came out with her just landing a lot of single kicks you know, to the body, a lot of movement, a lot of knees in the clinch. And then when she falls, they did a good job of, you know, I don't always agree with all of his commentary, but I actually thought that tonight was one of the better nights for Miletic as far as the Muay Thai breakdown, because Iman Barlow, when she sweeps you, she doesn't just go for that really cool, you know, hold your leg and just sweep you and you fall down. She falls with you with her forearm and your neck, which is what she was taught to do from a very young age, and that's being violent, you know, like that's a violent technique. So when she got her dump, she would do that, and then as rounds two and three wore on, one thing that I noticed real early on that was helping Iman was really timing her step knee well. So she really had the timing of, you know, Uzla was trying to close the distance, and Uzla's best offense was when she threw her boxing when Iman would throw like a low kick. So whenever that happened, she would usually find a right hand, something here and there, you know, sporadically. But for the most part, too strong. Barlow's kicks too strong. She had a snappy jab. She, you know, scored a really big knee in the fourth that had Uzla in trouble. Uzla held on to her body and stayed up. Uzla's toughness is not to be doubted. Like, it was a very clear dominant victory, one of the more dominant victories over Uzla that I've seen. More dominant than the, you know, of course, I've got Anissa Mexa as my number one fighter in the world for the female division. And I thought that the more dominant, you know, performance over Uzla came from Iman. And, you know, of those two. So Uzla was game. She stayed up and Iman, you know, went for the knee finish, but Uzla was able to hold on. Next round, she scored some good shots, and then she scored a really big elbow right at the end of the fight. If that had happened with maybe 2 minutes to go, I think they would have stopped it because of how quickly it started to bleed a lot. But she landed a big shot, and Uzla kind of had that. Whenever you see good elbows land, people kind of have like a hesitation look on their face, and then they back up, and that's what happened here. Shout out to Uzla, who really is one of the premier, you know, I guess journey women, if you will, but she's fought a lot of girls. She's fought them in their hometown, and she's traveled to make a career of it. When Uzla walks away from this sport, I think that she will look back on it and say, you know, I really did do the best of my ability. I really did fight the best in the world, and I did it all. Uzla fought Iman Barlow is her second time. She's fought Anissa Mexen before. She's gone down to Australia, to Perth, Australia, which is on the West Coast, which is, you know, not the, you know, most popular area for, you know, consistent Muay Thai, you know, international opportunities. They usually have to leave for those fights. Plus, it's tough for them to get people from the East to come out there to their card, so they do their best. But you get Uzla went down there, and she went against Kaylee Reese. She really did do her best job, and she's got some titles, and she's won some, you know, kickboxing K-1 rules events, but it just was Iman's day, who, as I said before, special fighter, been doing this her whole life, been fighting. You know, I love when her mom was saying that, you know, when she was younger, they just thought it was cute that she was putting on Thai, you know, shorts and starting to do, you know, the Thai class, because her mom was a 3-time British world champion. So they just thought it was cute when she was first starting to do it. And then it didn't take her long for her to realize she's starting to get good at this. And that's, that's why she's a prodigy in this sport. She's been doing this for a very, very young age, you know, since, you know, 4 or 5 years old. They talked about her fighting in Thailand at 7. And, of course, you know, you've got the inner squads and those kind of opportunities in England. But, man, she's had a great run. And it's crazy for me to, because I've known her since she was 15 years old, 16 years old. And to hear about her, to hear about her accolades, to see where she is. And then, like, when she had that period of time where she left the sport and she just was trying to be a regular teenager, you know, she went out drinking, partying, and, you know, living a young person's lifestyle. And then, or she puts it, doing things that athletes aren't supposed to be doing. And then she realized, it's not my parents' dream, it's my dream, and my parents have it too. And then that kind of changed everything. She, you know, got the weight off and then became one of the better fighters on the planet. Always excited to see her perform. Glad that people in the U.S., it's cool to go down my Twitter wall and see how many people are like, man, she's technically awesome. Man, she's good with her knees. Man, those body kicks are mean. Man, she's got a snappy jab. I think it's great when I see people appreciate her skill level, because I've been watching her for a really long time. We're going to go ahead and move down the card to, I don't know if I'm going to use the term controversy, but I'll go ahead and pay people their due because, you know, a lot of people did see it as controversial. I personally did not see it as super controversial, but I thought it was super close. You know, controversial to me is like, you know, it clearly should have went one way and it went the other way. And I didn't feel that was the case with this one at all. I'll save that. I will go ahead and go for the Anthony Njokuani fight. That's another one that, you know, happened on this card. So Chris Harrington, who is trained by the Hammer Castaneda. The Hammer, one of my favorite things about the Hammer is most people don't know this, but he did commentary for a very long time with Vinny Sherman. And Vinny Sherman, Mike Chiavello. Vinny Sherman does his work in England. Mike Chiavello and the Hammer have been together for a really long time in Australia, and they've done so many shows for Fox Sports because they'd usually do the show and then Fox Sports would like play it on delay later. But I'm telling you, for him to be here with Chris Harrington, his fighter, and to go against Anthony Njokuani, it just kind of, you know, made me almost, you know, you just kind of take a double take when I saw him there, and I go, wow, it's weird to see those two together, but not together. You know, one is commentary and one is doing his coaching thing. But the Hammer's had, you know, a successful gym, and he's been putting together athletes for a long time. He brings out Chris Harrington. Chris Harrington was game, and early on, he was pressuring. He was looking to score knees in a clinch, elbows, whereas Anthony Njokuani was slick. He was moving, touch and go, playing at a distance. Harrington did do a good job where he was able to cut him with one of his elbows. But in the end, Njokuani couldn't miss a right hand. Like, he just kept scoring it over and over. Chris Harrington was just kind of straight up and down, trying to walk him down. But one of the shots landed clean, got him in trouble, and it was just too much time in the round. Two more downs later, Chris Harrington loses to Anthony Njokuani. Njokuani, happy to do Muay Thai again. He actually had a pretty decent guy to go against. I wouldn't mind him fighting Ursel. I don't think they're going to go with that right away, but I wouldn't mind him fighting Ursel. That'd be fun. But Anthony Njokuani, very slick kind of Muay Thai style, looks for his boxing here and there, kind of plays a quick kick game more than a power kick game. And I'm just curious to see what happens to him down the road, see how much he fights. They had him at 22-0 in Muay Thai. I wasn't familiar. I knew of his Muay Thai fights. I didn't know he got up to 22. But I'm happy for him, happy that he got this opportunity. So shout out to Njokuani, who's been a combat sports fighter for a long time. You know, he fought in, the UFC, of course, had some opportunities outside of it for Bellator, for Legacy. Didn't work out his way because of the grappling in MMA. But, man, guy's not too bad on the feet, so good stuff. We're going to go ahead and, you know, move on to, as I mentioned before, it came with a little bit of controversy, not super, but enough controversy for me to be like, all right, let's go ahead and address this issue. Sorry about that. There's a little hesitation. Gabriel Mazzetti gets a victory over Chris Chastain, and I thought that a lot of people were really, you know, leaning that, you know, Chastain got the victory over Mazzetti. And I understand why there was some separation. And I'll go ahead. You know, before I was a little hesitant to go with the word controversial. You know, as I kind of go through my notes, I'm gonna revisit that and say, you know what? There were some close rounds where I can see it going the other way. Controversial to me, I usually feel if it was so clear for one person, you're upset if that person's name doesn't get called. But I think that goes under the category of robbery. So in my mind, I think that I'm kind of mixing it up a little bit. If controversy means that, hey, there's some discussion to be made over who you think the actual winner is, I'm fine with that because I do think that that's what came into play in this fight. For me personally, I had Chastain taking round one, and I had Gabriel Mazzetti winning rounds 2, 3, and 4, and then I had the last round, round five going to Chastain. Now, I think where controversy came into play and, you know, hesitation came into play was with, what was it, the scorecard of, I think there were two 49-46s and one 48-47. 48-47 is what I had, so I got no problem there. But 49-46, for me, I thought that rounds one and rounds five were clear. They were clear rounds, my personal opinion, for Chastain. I thought rounds 2, 3, and 4, I thought 4 was clear for Mazzetti, but I thought rounds 2 and 3 were rounds where there was definitely some work done by Chastain as well, but I thought Mazzetti did better work in those rounds. Chastain did throw with a lot of volume, but one thing I also noticed that came with his volume was he would, I guess, when he threw in flurries and he finished with a high kick on the end, I thought that a lot of it was getting hit by the arms of Mazzetti, and then he would throw the kick on the end. So I thought the defense was pretty sound there. But the flurry and the high kick will always look good, especially look good on scorecards. But I thought that just the clean connects, I thought that they really did go in favor of Mazzetti. And then that's just kind of how I saw it. Now, ringside, it sounded like both Chiavello and Miličić had a very close decision. I won't say wide because they didn't say their scorecards. I don't remember their scorecards. I think maybe it was 49-46 for Chastain, if I remember correctly. But I'm guessing there. I can't remember what his final scorecards were. But I do remember that Miličić for sure felt the winner of the fight was Chastain. And, of course, the commentary, everybody, they were surprised by Chastain's performance. And I'll be the first one to say that. I was surprised by his performance. So maybe that's why the cards probably and the commentary kind of gravitated towards that story, because he did so much better than people thought. He came out, he had buzz, he had this, you know, undefeated streak going, and the next thing you know, he had some losses, and people just didn't think that he was ever going to be what he is supposed to be. So he goes down to Thailand, he gets some fights, he gets some training, comes back, he put on a good performance, and I think all those factors maybe led to people thinking that he won the fight. For me, as I said before, I thought he did really good, and there were some competitive rounds, but I just really liked the work of Mazzetti when they were in close, and I thought that he landed cleaner shots. Not that Chastain didn't have some moments where he, you know, rocked Mazzetti's head back, but I thought Mazzetti had the better work. So that's where I leaned for that one. So I had Gabriel Mazzetti winning that fight. So go ahead and wrap that card up on that note. I didn't want to talk about the full card. Just normally, I usually just kind of talk about the, you know, top 3-4 fights. I may be missing 2 on this card, but those are the main ones that I wanted to talk about for Lion Fight. And now we're going to go over to Thailand. We're going to go to Thailand where Raja had a show on the 2nd of February. And got some good stuff. 3 fights I'm going to talk to you guys about. 1 fight I definitely want you to sit down and take the time and really, really enjoy, because it was a great back and forth. Go ahead and start off with the most notable fight in the card, Pompeyuk versus Superlek. Superlek gets the victory here. My thing with this was, I thought that the pacing of Pompeyuk, who has really shown some really good work in the knees, and I remember somebody posted on Twitter that, you know, this loss probably means he won't be fighter of the year. Pompeyuk did have a solid year last year, and he came out and he kind of played a distance game, and then I started to realize this guy never changed. He never picked up the pace. There's never a sense of urgency. There's never anything that kind of suggested that more effort was coming. Instead, Superlek dominated with, you know, work in the clinch, clean kicks to the body, and defense. Did a really good job of checking a lot of kicks and movement. It's just, he's a very talented dude, and he's a guy who I expect to get big wins all the time. But Pompeyuk was on a roll, and he was up for contention for fight of the year. Not saying that he's out of it. I'm just saying that's going to be a little bit tougher with this loss. And the way with Muay Thai. Muay Thai was on a roll last year, a bunch of elbow stoppages, and then he lost his last two. So it makes you wonder who they're going to pick or if his name is going to come up again. So anyway, Superlek gets the victory over Pompeyuk. Next fight on the card I'm going to talk about, and one more time, is to talk about this stadium show. Go to Muay Thai's MuayTies on YouTube. Go check them out. He does a good job of uploading some of the major cards and sometimes the not so major cards. Just, you know, great Muay Thai action. He does his work to get those out there to the people. So shout out to him for putting this up. So next, I'm going to talk to you about a really, really awesome KO Kay Mukau gets a KO victory over Pet Yutong. Kay Mukau, it's coming out, and it's the action. I mean, the video is only 1 minute and 33 seconds. So basically, Kay Mukau comes out, and they're landing consistent. I mean, you know, offense are kind of filling their pacing. And then Kaimukau lands a body kick and he backs up. And Pet Yutong is pursuing. So he's, you know, bringing his feet and he's throwing offense. And Kaimukau leans back, or Kaimukau, however you want to say it, leans back and fires an elbow right over the top. And Pet Yutong is gone. He drops flat, lands out cold, clean. Very cool KO to check out. PET. -U-TONG is Pet Yutong, and then the victory was won by Kaimukau, Kaimukau. Definitely clean KO. Pullback, right elbow, killer. Beautiful stuff. Now for the fight that I couldn't wait to tell you guys about because I watched right before I did this podcast. Pet Dom versus Suokim was just an awesome battle. PETDAM for Pet Dom, who was in red, and SUAKIM for Suokim, who was in blue in this one. So this is why this fight was great, okay? It starts off with Suokim comes out, and he lands a good 3-2 in the third round. So he lands a hook cross and puts a body kick behind it, and all of a sudden he starts to take over the fight. He's winning the boxing exchanges. He's winning some kicks, and he's also dominating in the clinch, closing the distance. Pet Dom was looking for opportunities to battle back. He was throwing elbows in between, but for the most part, he was being outscored. He then gets a shot, and he's in trouble. His mouthpiece comes out, and he goes into the corner, and as soon as there's a clean break, they decide to go and let him get his mouthpiece back in. I can't remember if I saw this correctly, and pardon me once to look for it, you know, while I'm actually talking to you guys, but it looks like from his corner, it's not one of the cornermen that go in and get his mouthpiece and wash it out of water. It looks like a promoter of some sort. I'm going off memory here. And when he puts the mouthpiece in, he's like yelling at him, and he smacks Pet Dom. Again, not something you see all the time, but it worked. And as soon as he goes out there, Pet Dom starts throwing hands, and the round comes to an end shortly afterwards. But man, was he mean with those hands in that brief period of time, which set up what was going to happen in an awesome round four, one of the rounds of the year. Pet Dom comes out, throwing hands all the time. Suokim still having, you know, success with his hands, still having success in the clinch, throwing a body kick here and there, but the pace had changed completely. All of a sudden, Pet Dom just starts throwing heat, and Suokim doesn't go to the clinch and allows positions. He tries to match the outcome. So not only is Pet Dom throwing a lot of boxing, but he's also ripping these awesome body kicks. And after a while, Suokim visibly shows the damage from both the physical shots that he was taking, but most importantly, the work rate of the round seemed to show up on him. And he starts to slow, and as he's slowing, Pet Dom is just picking him away with kicks and offense, and all of a sudden he's battled back all the way to the point where he is in the lead. He is now winning the fight after four. Big time comeback for him. And then we go to round five. Pet Dom's clearly, you know, I'm telling you, if you looked at his corner after round three, they were yelling at him. If you looked at his corner after round four, Pet Dom had did what he was supposed to do. But Suokim was not about to let this victory just slide away. He continued to pressure, look for opportunities for offense, look for opportunities for offense. And he looked so tired and run down the round before, but he found like a second breath. So he continues to score consistent offense, and then he gets an opportunity to land a few shots, get in the clinch. The body kicks that were knocking him off balance so bad at the end of round four weren't as effective this time as he closed the distance. And then all of a sudden, he has a series where he gets into the clinch and he must have landed about 10 knees unanswered. Like just, you know, I think he's got collar tie and he's in the bicep on the right side and he's just letting them go, just letting these knees go. And as he's scoring these big time shots, I look at the corners, and both guys are cheering for their guy, and both guys stop. Of course, this happens in Thailand a lot. Fifth round, if you're up, you usually stop. And if you've come back, you think you've done enough work to sway the crowd, you usually stop. Of course, there's also a cultural element to it. These guys still send a lot of this money home to their families. It's not like they're, you know, packing it away so they can live the good life when they're done. This money goes home. So in the fifth round, usually if a guy's winning, you will see them, you know, slow it down, start to dance around, let the round end. That way the guy can recover and make food for his family, you know, have the opportunity to compete so that he can make money for his family down the road. So as soon as Suo Kim felt like he had done enough work, he stopped and started dancing around. Pet Dom the same, and he's kind of hesitant because he wondered if he did enough work in round four to secure the victory. But at the same time, he's also looking at Suo Kim bouncing around and being excited in there. Pet Dom's corner did tell him to go over there. He looked like he was going to engage again, but Suo Kim was done working. They go to the cards. Suo Kim gets the victory. It is awesome. It is Muay Thai at its best. It gives you a little bit of every element. But my favorite part about it, my two favorite parts about it, one was what looked like a promoter or a manager who hopped in there and replaced his mouthpiece and was yelling at him, get going. That's always cool because you rarely see that. Two, it's just the back and forth nature of it and the fact that Suo Kim didn't give up in the fifth. He went after it. And I've seen that happen sometimes where guys just, the other person's playing prevent the whole time and you just find your offense. And Suo Kim had success in the clinch throughout the fight. But this series that he gets in the fifth round, when you watch it with your eyes, you're like, oh yeah, that lost him the fight. So definitely good stuff there. I am doing my best to return to the stadium shows. This is my first time revisiting it. They had three fights go up a day ago, so I wanted to talk to you guys about that Rogers show. So thank you very much. For those who've been patient with me in this area, I will try to do my best to get you guys full rules Muay Thai action as we move forward. Definitely want to make sure I'm hit up the stadiums because I know I have a fan base that really likes that. So going to go ahead and move on and talk about some, you know, some notes before I go into, you know, one of the segments on kind of what makes someone great. It's been announced that Glory is going to Brussels, and that is awesome. And the reason why I am a big fan of that, it's because I heard on, you know, another podcast, on the Liver Kick podcast, that they're going to try to focus, and I've said it on this podcast before, but it's come up again. They're really going to try to focus on the European market as they move the Glory brand forward. They went ahead and they tried the U.S. and they're going to keep doing U.S. stuff. And they're going to keep trying to build U.S. fighters on the undercards, but it is very, very important to them that they focus on or move the brand in a direction that reflects the better fighters in the world. And I think Europe gives the best option. Now, again, the Brussels card has got too many names that I'm familiar with, so I'm not that excited for it, though I always want to see high-level kickboxing action. But it's cool that they went out there and they decided to put the effort into putting this show together, and I'm excited to see what happens with Glory as they, you know, bring out Cedric Dumbe. He's going to go against Johan Kangulo. I'll break the fight down when we get closer to it. All I wanted to bring up was them going to Brussels is an opportunity for us to see high-level kickboxing and in Europe, where the audiences come out. And so good stuff there. Dylan Salvador is going against Sidichai for the lightweight title. So it's some good stuff. In the rumor mill, Rico Van Herven did what he did with the Badr Hari thing. He went out to a talk show and he said that he wanted to fight Badr. They made that happen. So then he goes on to his, you know, I think the same talk show or a similar talk show. And they decide that he's going to go against Rami Bonjasky. And Rami Bonjasky, who agreed a few weeks ago that if Gokhan Saki wanted to fight him again, he'd fight him. He then says that he's down for the fight. Now, Glory has not made this official. They've not said that this is what they wanted to do. For all I know, they had to pay Rico Verheeven some good money to do the Badr Hari fight. Maybe they ain't trying to do that again. Or as much. I'd be surprised by that, because if Rico is still trying to fight kickboxing, let him keep fighting kickboxing. I don't know what his deal is. I don't know how many fights you have him under wraps. But if he's interested in fighting kickboxing and growing his legacy against guys who, you know, Remy Bonjasky's way past his prime, but Remy will go out there for three rounds and try to go the distance and try to win a low kick battle. I like that Rico Verheeven is committed to still trying to win and compete in kickboxing, because he's been winning for a long time. It's been pretty consistent. There's only the one hiccup to Andrei Kuzmichuk. Other than that hiccup, Rico Verheeven has been putting in that work for these last few years. So definitely good that he's getting that fight. Definitely cool that Remy Bonjasky's down to take the fight. Now you just got to find the right place to do it. Clearly, that fight can't happen anywhere close to the United States. So I'm hoping that they don't think this is the card or that's the fight to bring to New York or that's the fight to bring to anywhere other than Holland. You know, like keep it right where it is. So hopefully that fight materializes and maybe they do that on another super card at some period of time this year. But Remy's been down to fight every name that's come his way. Gokhan Saki said he wanted to fight again. Remy's down to fight him. Badahari, he's down to fight him. Remy, I think he's financially fine, but I think he misses it, you know, and that's tough. If you've gone out there, Remy Bonjasky was on the one of the last cards to be at the Tokyo Dome. You never get that feeling back. You never get the feeling back of fighting in front of that many people. Now, he didn't have 100,000, 90,000, 80,000 at the one that he won. I think he had like 60,000 or something like that, but still huge. And for a guy who fought in, you know, K1 and in Japan as much as he did, it's hard to walk away from that. Not to mention he fought for It's Showtime at Amsterdam Arena. I think he just misses it. And when it's gone forever. And there's a reason why Peter Arts hung on for as long as he possibly could. He's 46 years old. They get his last fight at 45. He's losing to guys that in his prime, he could have beaten as easy as possible. But he's old. He's older. So his last claim to, you know, his last big victory, I'd say, would be the Ben Sadiq. And I'm happy for him. I'm happy that Arts had that opportunity. Remy Bonjasky did a good job of leaving. And, of course, he had the eye injury and he had a leg injury. And he went through it. And I think he did it to the best of his ability. He leaves the sport a legend. A guy who, I'm telling you, so many people hated when he was coming up. Didn't like him. Preferred barter, that kind of deal, whatever. But after his career was done, to hear people talk about him now, I just laugh. I'm like, I can't believe we are where we are right now with this guy. So if he is still around, three-time K1 World Grand Prix champion, he wants to fight Rico Verheerven, let's do it. That sounds like it's a lot of fun. April 22nd, we got K1 Japan Bantamweight tournament. It is their World Grand Prix, and of course, the most notable thing is they will not have Takuru in the tournament field. He's going to be in a super fight against Victor Saravia. I'll talk about that later because that's actually a pretty damn good fight because Saravia, he is not as experienced and he's usually more of a full rules Muay Thai fighter, fought in Lion Fight a few times, but he doesn't have a bunch of fights, but he's got all the athleticism and he could punch hard and he's got a big time low kick. It'll be a lot of fun to see him compete, so I'm glad that he's getting this opportunity. Tournament's got, you know, again, I won't get into it big, because I really want to, you know, focus on this one. We get a little bit closer to it, but what do we have here? Charles Bongiovanni, the guy, of course, who was in one of the better fights with Takuru, he's in the tournament field. Ishida Kyusuke is in it. Takai Ishiki is in it. Antonio Ordan. Jamie Whalen's my favorite name as he goes against Tirado Nobuchika. Tirado, an awesome fighter, and Jamie Whalen is a guy who double K here in Kittle's gym. He's you know, in England, world champion, really good guy. He recently popped up on the Idris Elba kickboxing thing. I'm going to wait until that last episode comes out. I've pretty much seen every episode except for the last one, but I'll give a breakdown of the Idris Elba show. I thought that that's kickboxing news, so I'm going to talk about it for sure. So, fun tournament field. Kubo Genji is another guy. I'm excited to see how this goes. Hiroya goes against Yamada Tetsuya. That's a really fun super fight. Kufertex is in action against Yamasaki Hideki. Fun stuff from this card. So just wanted to go ahead and bring it up. I'll actually break the card down when we get closer. But we've got that. We've got Infusion on the 18th. So it's 22nd, 18th. That's a big-time kickboxing weekend. Not to mention Glory is the following week. So kickboxing in February is actually pretty hot right now. So we got a lot of fun stuff going on. I'm so grateful that you guys have, you know, been following me. And sometimes we get something that's obscure. It's not necessarily always going to be, you know, on a big card, but sometimes you get some of the biggest news. What is it? Muhammad Davy gets a knockout over Anatoly Moiseev on, you know, a head kick knockout on some kung fu card where they're fighting with, like, you know, kickboxing pants, you know, old school. I'm actually looking it up right now just to make sure I'm remembering that correctly. But they fought with shoes and with, you know, pants on. But Muhammad Davy gets a big-time KO there off the head kick. As far as Anatoly Moiseev losing, doesn't bother me at all because I'm from an older school. My age, my day and age of kickboxing, that kind of thing happened. You had a great year, and you could be fighter of the year if you went 9-1 because sometimes you're going to get that L if you're competing all the time. So I really like that Moiseev is out there not waiting for the next, you know, glory call. He's just being busy, and he's being a prize fighter. I think that's very, very important. Let me see. I think that should do it as far as cards and breakdowns. So I will go ahead and wrap the show up with what makes someone great, okay? And I am going to go ahead and use the example of Peter Arts. And Peter Arts is K-1 heavyweight, one of the greats of all time. Sometimes people will talk about Sammy Schilt and his run, and because he's got, you know, what would amount to 4 K-1 World Grand Prix. And then, of course, we've got Arts with 3, Bonjowski with 3, Ernesto Hoost had 4, and even though, you know, his fourth one, of course, is a step down because, of course, the injury, but a victory is a victory, so shout out to him. So I want to talk to you guys about why he's great. So I want to start with what I said on Twitter when this came up. We're comparing Rico's era, and they say, hey, man, how does Rico's era step up? Where does he go all time? You know, he's been winning for a while and so on. And I was like, hey, Rico's an awesome fighter, and he is going to be a great. He's going to be remembered as a great. And he's gone so far because, as I said before, if you watch my kickboxing documentary, I interviewed Simon Roots, who is the It Showtime owner, and he got the deal with K1 when he first put on the show at Amsterdam Arena when he did shows in Holland. And I interviewed him, and I asked him about Rico Verheerven, and he says on camera that he truly believed that Rico Verheerven was going to be the future of kickboxing. He was going to be a heavyweight kickboxing champion for a time to come. And the next day, he got knocked out by Jamal Ben Sadiq. I remember it. I was there. I vividly remember that. And I was like, what is he seeing? And then all of a sudden, slowly, he started to put it together. Started to get those wins. Lost to Errol Zimmerman by KO. Came back, beat Errol Zimmerman down the road. You know, went through a tournament, and he got to Sammy Schilt. And he said, after Sammy Schilt didn't stop him, he started to think to himself, you know, I think I can do this. I think I can be the best in the world. And, you know, if you saw my kickboxing documentary, he says, hey, when you get to the top, you're not going to just get there. He said, you're going to stay there. And that's what happened to Rico Verheerven. He is putting together his era, and he's putting together his championship right now. But let me tell you why Peter Arts is great. Okay, let's go ahead and start with this. 1991. 2006, he beats Mark Russell, all right? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27, 28, 29. He didn't lose one time between that date and 1996-2003, he has one loss. He lost to Ernesto Hoost one time, and he had a draw with Misaki Satake, but, you know, whatever. And it was kind of a Kyokushin karate-type deal. But those list of names, that's 29 wins, and that was, as I said before, from 1991 to 1996. He beat Jean-Claude Loyer, course, that we know the head kick there, Mike Bernardo, Sam Greco, Jerome LeBanner, Ernesto Hoost, Masaki Satake beat him again, Patrick Smith, who was one of the better kickboxers in the world. All those victories came, Maurice Smith, get the other Smith, all those victories came against, and a lot of these guys are KO losses. I'll go ahead and just take a sample, okay? I'll go ahead and go through this again. 1992, May, he gets a KO victory over Adam West. He then wins his next fight by KO. The fight after that by KO, he gets a draw. He then wins by KO again, loses to Ernesto Hoost, and then he goes on to win the next 5 fights by KO. In 1993, September 4th, my birthday, he won by KO, and then he went on to win by KO until 1994, April 30th, against Masaki Tanaka. He won by decision. And then he won the next, what, five fights by KO? So, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So, this guy, 7 fights by KO. So, he had one decision glip in there, and he had won like 12 fights by KO in a row. Rico Verhoeven is awesome, but he ain't doing that to the best guys in the world in his prime. He hasn't done that yet. You know, he's working it out. Maybe he starts getting some stoppages later. I mean, even though the Rico thing was an injury, that's a stoppage. But that's who Peter Arts is. Peter Arts has highlights of him just getting KOs. There is no kickboxing action in it. It's just KO. So there's no combination low kick flow, just a bunch of KOs. He gets KOs with head kicks, crosses, knees, any way you wanted, body shots. Peter Arts was doing it. So when I talk about someone being great, and again, I'm only going through, I stopped at 96. You know, I think he went on to beat Andy Hoog down the road, of course. I stopped Andy Hoog, I should say. Jerome LeBanner got a victory over him, but he stopped Jerome a lot. He stopped Mike Bernardo a lot. Bernardo had that 3-5 win streak on him, but he stopped Bernardo. Like, he goes out there and he beat some of the best guys in the world on a regular basis. And I did everything I told you guys was early career stuff. I did 96 from below. I'll go ahead and bring it up. 1998. Thank you, Wikipedia, for all this information, by the way. 1998, and September 27th. He then goes on to beat, you know, he beats Sinisa Andrej Sijovic. He goes on and beats this gentleman, and then he wins Masaki Satake, KO. Mike Bernardo, KO. Andy Hoog, KO. Michael McDonald, KO. Jim Mullen, KO. Matt Skelton, TKO. Maurice Smith, TKO. Sam Greco, KO. That is from 1998 to 1999. I just ran off 9 fights. This guy is amazing. This guy is, and that is after what would be, you know, they actually had the promo, who could beat Peter Arts. This is after that era. He is still knocking people out. And let's not forget, after this is all said and done, after all these losses, he gets into the 2000s. You're going to see, you go to his Wikipedia, you're going to see a lot more pink, you know, green means win. Their pink color usually means the losses. So you're going to see a lot more, you know, L's in that period of time. But despite that, despite the fact that there were some losses, late in his career, when it's all said and done, when he's starting to lose, when things aren't consistent, he's not the young man that he used to be, I look at his career and I see victories over Semi Schilt. He won the series 3-2 at the very end of his career. So after a great K1 World Grand Prix run, after being a legend, at the very end he was able to produce one more great moment. He was able to get more victories over Semi Schilt and Semi Schilt's era than when he fought in his prime. So at the very end of his career, in his late 30s, early 40s, he's able to knock off the guy who dominated his era. That's why Peter Arts is great. So when we talk about great fighters of all time, clearly, K1 World Grand Prix, you got to go Semi Schilt. Semi Schilt was great. You got to look at, you know, Ernesto Hoost and his longevity and winning in different weight classes. Those guys are great. But for you guys to understand just how great Peter Arts is, it's not just that he's got 3 K1 World Grand Prix. There was a period of time where he was murdering everybody. He was winning by KO. So definitely, when you revisit the annals of what makes kickboxing great, you got to remember that Ernesto Hoost, Andy Hoog, Mike Bernardo, those guys were not just great fighters, but great fighters that got victories over other great fighters, and Peter Arts knocked out all those guys. You know, I think maybe Hoost might be the only one that didn't lose by KO to Arts. I think he lost by decision both times, but still, this guy's special. This guy's special. So I will go ahead and do this similar breakdown with other fighters, but I wanted to start with Peter Arts so you guys really understand what we say, what we mean by Peter Arts is an all-time great. It's more than just the 100-plus wins. It's who you beat, how'd you beat him, And how many times did you win by stoppage? That stuff comes, that comes into play for me. Thank you all for listening to the podcast. I'll do my best to stay with it. I'll do my best to keep giving you guys full rules Muay Thai, give you guys, you know, line fight, all the kickboxing action that's going on. I will be back next week. I'm going to try to keep it regular. I've been posting them on Saturday, but they'll probably be end of the week stuff unless I travel. If I travel, sometimes I'm not 100% confident in what the internet's going to be, so I might do the show before I leave. But as of right now, everything's all to the good. God bless. Thank you so much for listening and following my podcast. A gentleman found me on Facebook just the other day to tell me that he liked my podcast, and that made my day. So definitely I do this because I love it, and I want to keep getting the kickboxing action out to you guys. And God bless. Thank you all very much, and I definitely want to take time out because, again, the gentleman found me on Facebook and sent me a message. I definitely want to say thank you to Michael, I hope I'm pronouncing your name right, Mikowski from Austin, Texas. He hit me up. He said he found out I'm on a podcast show because he heard me on another podcast. And I'm so grateful for you and everybody else who follows this podcast. Peace. Have a good one. And check out Iman Barlow. Check out Peter Arts and his greatness. Check out those stadium fights. Have a good one, y'all. Peace.